We are changing gears, slightly changing gears now, to look at how essential organs are built. And we're going to start with Anne Grappin, who is the director at the Max Planck Institute, the same Max Planck Institute, actually, of molecular cell biology and genetics in Dresden, who's going to tell us about pancreas.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here today. Particularly great because I have a link, a historical link with this place. I did my PhD at the Collège de France, so it's being back, and it's always hard to be back. And Denis, maybe a clin d'œil to start with. You can see that we can classify them, and it's a continuum, at least at some stages. So as Denis said, we're moving slightly later in development, past gas relation, and we work on the formation of one organ, the pancreas, which forms from endoderm that you heard about from several of the speakers, including Jesse. And this organ forms from the endoderm with an epithelial group of cells, about 500 cells, which start, they proliferate heavily, and they start differentiating, forming endocrine cells that will release hormones. And these endocrine cells move to the periphery, forming the initial islets of Langerhans. At the same time, it's the beginning of the formation of the ductal network, which starts actually from local rosettes of polarity, which remodel with time and will form a continuous structure, ductal structure. At some point in the middle of development, you start seeing at the tips these acinar cells, which are the cells that will produce the enzymes that digest food. So these cells produce enzymes and they're released into the ductal network and finally into the duodenum. So eventually you get a very, very large organ which has a network of branches. It keeps generating endocrine cells until birth and it stops. And these endocrine cells get connected to the blood vessels, which is functionally important because they will release hormones into the bloodstream. And the exocrine cells will also be secretory, and they secrete enzymes that digest food. These yellow cells, ductal cells, also release fluid. So all these cells are specialized in secretion. So we work a lot in vivo. I started working only in vivo. I love the embryo. It's reproducible, it's reliable, but it had limitations. We started working with organoids more than 12 years ago, and at that time, our incentive was that the primordium was too small, 500 cells, we couldn't do chromatin IP, we couldn't do biochemistry seriously. If it were now, maybe we would never have started because it's easy to work with 500 cells now, but it wasn't more than 10 years ago. So what we were trying to find was an in vitro system where we could generate a lot of cells. The way we started actually was from the very early primordium of the pancreas. So very differently from what you heard in the previous talks, where they start with hundreds or thousands of cells. Here we dissociate the cells and we seed them from the early embryo and we start observing what they form. And they form these very beautiful structures in about 1 week. So why do we work with organoids now? As Jesse said, there are many limitations with the embryos in the type of manipulation you want to do. It's hidden in the womb. But mostly because in vitro, we think we can control the process. We can visualize it by live imaging, but we can also control what kind of cells you assemble, how many you assemble together, what's the unit forming an organ. And you can observe how the cells work together to make more than the sum of the parts and see emergent properties. So the way we start from the early pancreas, we dissociate the cells, we feed them in 3D in matrix gel, and being in 3D is important, otherwise many genes are downregulated and they're no longer pancreas progenitors. And we have two different media that we started working with, inspired from what we knew of our development, which is much less than the early stages of development, and inspired also just doing cooking, honestly. And we had two different outcomes. These are very complex structures which go from a few cells to 20,000 cells in just 1 week. And this very simple one, which grow but never more than about 100 cells, and they're spherical and they're a monolayer of cells with a very large lumen. If you compare to the pancreas in vivo at 12 and a half days of development, so each dot here is a single cell, here as well, same reporter. What you can see is that the structures here are fairly isotropic, whereas the dorsal or the ventral pancreas are very elongated. So that's a limitation that we have in the in vitro system. It remains rather spherical. However, what we can recapitulate is the branching patterns. We can recapitulate the differentiation of cell types with progenitors that remain more in the center, lining a big ductal network that you see in white here. It doesn't look connected because it's a section, but if you look in 3D, it's all connected eventually. Acinar cells at the tips, and a few endocrine cells in the system. In the sphere medium, we have essentially progenitors, and we recapitulate the differentiation into endocrine cells more efficiently than acinar cells, very few acinar cells. So for a long time, we've been trying to understand there are quite a few differences between the two media, how the media control these two different outcomes. And the answer is not simple. It's not like one component that does everything. But we've been able to see, for instance, that if we use this B27, so we've tried to replace components one by one. It was not the most effective strategy because there were too many, and many act redundantly. So instead, what we did is we did transcriptome analysis to see what the cells read from what is in the medium, and it was most productive. We could see, for instance, that this B27 has thyroid hormone, and this thyroid hormone is what enables the formation of so many endocrine cells. And we can then go to the mouse embryo, and by inactivating the thyroid hormone receptor A, we see that it's also important in the in vivo setting. So you can really make discoveries from scratch, from an in vitro system that can be validated, not all of them. So how does the system behave? How does it self-organize? So I just told you that there's some control exerted by what you put in the medium. But it also responds according to its state. So if we take the pancreas progenitors at 10 and a half or 11 and a half of development, they form these two types of structure according to the medium. However, if we take the pancreas progenitors at a later time point, 12.5, 14.5, they all go into these structures. Because we know from clonal analysis in vivo since then that if we track single cells, by that time point, there is no multipotent progenitor. There's no cell that has capacity to form all the three lineages. So we don't get the acinar cells that enable the formation of these structures. What we also know is that the system doesn't start from a single cell, but that the initial cell number matters, and the cell states that you put in and you mix together matter. So we know that from looking either in a bulk culture where you focus on areas where you have one cell, two cells, three cells, or now what we can do is use microwells where we can by design assemble one cell, two cells, three cells. So sometimes the cells land as single cells, sometimes doublets, sometimes 10 cells. And what they do immediately, they polarize. So they compact and they form junctions that you see marked here by echidirin, and they polarize to form an initial rosette. So that's the apical side here. And the basal side is facing the matrix, and we know that the matrix is what controls the polarity. So what we observed at that time is that if we start from a single cell, it never forms any organoid or any sphere, depending on the medium. But if we start from four cells, we have a 20% chance that they will expand and form a structure. And if we start from 12, it works 100% of the time. So I won't show you the data because I want to talk more about human today. But we know that there are cells when we see them that are not active and cells that are not inactive, and that they crosstalk, and these exchange of signals in the notch pathway enables the system to start. So The organoids can be used not only to understand how structures emerge, cell types, and morphogenesis, but also to try to understand the mechanical control, because the environment is less complex. So one simple, and that's something we just started when I moved to Dresden, so the stories are not fully finished, but this one is fairly mature. So what we observe when we make the spheres is that you can see here when you make movies, okay, play it again. All right, it doesn't work the second time. All right, I'm not gonna get it to play. So you can look at the, so this is a section, and this is a 3D Z projection image. And what you can see is that we have some structures that move, that do rotations. So there's a collective movement, and it's a sustained collective movement that's oriented. And in some cases, like this one, the axis changes with time. We also have structures that don't move at all. So we were very fascinated by what was happening there. And what we understand now is that these cells here work as a collective, and they are, well, the first thing they do is that they don't not happy in matrix gel, they start making their own matrix, and they produce very large amounts of matrix protein. Laminin is only one of them, but you can see how thick it is around the little structure. And they use this matrix as an anchor to do crawling. So what they do here is that if you look at actin, but you can also do that with myosin, you can see that they have actin a lot on the apical side, but they also have areas of actin that change with time on the basal side. And we know that they're making focal contact, and we can block the rotation using focal adhesion kinase inhibitors or inhibitors of the anchoring with integrins. So the cells exert attraction on the matrix. But why do they move in a coordinated manner? Why don't each single cell move randomly? So to do that, we had to become a lot more quantitative. And that's what we spend a lot of time dealing with, doing quantitative analysis in 3D, which is not trivial. So it started working much better when we had a MIT graduate joining the lab in the Elbe program. And he could do quantitative analysis. So we could do PIV, particle image velocimetry, and quantify how the cells move, each single cell, in the object. At the same time, when you see how they move, you can compute the axis. So we see that they move usually in the beginning with a single axis of rotation, and this axis toggles and changes with time. Now you can quantify that, and for each object, you can quantify the angular velocimetry, the speed of rotation, but also the axis orientation. So based on this data, we collaborated with physicists at the Institute for the Physics of Complex Systems, notably the lab of Frank Hülicher. And Frank designed a very simple model, which is a vertex model, where each cell is represented by a set of vertices, and each vertex forms a tricellular junction. And then the model has two components. First, the force, so the traction. And the second, so in the force equation, we have both a component that is the force exerted from the junctions with other cells and the traction on the matrix. And we have a polarity component, which actually monitors how the cells align each of their polarities. Yeah? So the polarity equation is the alignment of polarity of individual cells. So you can start the model with a random assigned polarity of the cells. And what the cells do, movies are not playing very nicely, sorry about that. So you can see that even though they start randomly, they align the polarity and they can start rotating because they exert their motor, their traction in the same direction. So now you can use the model and enter different parameters of traction force, how much traction on the matrix there is, and how much the alignment rate of the different cells is, how well they align. And we see that at low traction force and strong alignment rate, what we have is a solid body rotation. So they rotate consistently in the same orientation, all the cells do the same. However, if we work at high traction force and low alignment rate, the cells never manage to reach equilibrium and they rearrange their neighbors constantly. What's interesting is what happens here at the interface. At this phase, there's a phase transition here, a yielding transition, in which what we can see is that the cells align, but they can change coherently their axis of rotation with time. And that's exactly what we observe with these embryos, spheroids that can change rotation axis. So this work shows that the cells can work together to do a collective migration. But in vitro, the system is spherical. In vivo, it's not spherical. All our cells are organized in tubes. So what we don't know yet at the moment is what does it mean to in vivo situation? Do the cells migrate along the tubes? Do they migrate linearly? Do they migrate forming spirals? That's what we're trying to understand, but we think it's relevant to the formation of the branch tree architecture. So what we would like to understand now is move to a more complex system, which is moving away from the spheres. How do you form this complex geometry of lumen, which is going to be important for the network of the pancreas? So we know that it starts in vivo from the formation of microlumen, which will connect to form a complex network with a lot of loops, and that with time, these loops disappear and it becomes a perfect tree. But in vivo, it's very complex. So in vitro, what we can observe is that when we start from two cells that are compact together, or from a cell division, we have the formation of the first apical polarity and the formation of the first lumen. And when the cell divides again, you have the formation of a new lumen. And with time, in the sphere system, the cells start pumping heavily, and the epithelium is tight, and what we observe is that these microlumen merge with the main lumen. So eventually we go to a single lumen. And that's what happens in the very large tubes of the pancreas. However, in the organoid conditions, these lumen merge, but they actually elongate. We think it's because they don't have high enough pressure, and also because actomyosin activity is differential around the epithelium, around the apical side. So now what we can do with this system, we can monitor in the organoid how these lumens change over time with light heat microscopy. And you can see that it's very complex hydrostatic behaviors, where you have some lumen that empty, others that get larger. And we can now follow the single lumen, at least the large ones, and we can see how they deform over time. So you can see these lumen here, that we can segment and follow, and you can see how it elongates over time. So what we don't know yet, because we don't have single cell segmentation, is what's the importance of cell rearrangements in this process. And we think it's going to be very important from visual inspection. So we can do a lot of things in mouse, but in the end, organoids are also a system that enable us to investigate development in something that's less accessible, which is human. The systems we've developed in human start either, like in mouse, from the fetal human pancreas. We don't get a lot of them. Or we can engineer the system starting from ES or iPS cells. So I will talk today more about the ES and iPS cells. So the engineering process is very well controlled up to the pancreas progenitors, because a lot of labs in the world work on that with the aim of producing beta cells for a therapy of diabetic patients. So thanks to their work, what we could do is produce in 2D pancreas progenitors, and then we can see them in 3D. And in 3D, they start from these little aggregates. So what we observe is that we can seed these aggregates, and with time, they grow. They maintain their pancreas progenitor identity. There's some heterogeneity in the system. Some have more complex networks of ducts. Some have very simple sphere with a lumen inside. But what's very convenient is that we can continue the system continuously, which we can't do in the mouse or with the human embryos, not a lot of passaging. Here we can replate the cells every 10 days and they maintain their identity and they maintain a stable karyotype. We can freeze them, so it's very convenient. We can also have huge amounts of cells, so we can investigate things in parallel. But what I was more worried about as a developmental biologist was, are we working really with something that looks like an embryo? So to investigate that, we did benchmarking by single cell sequencing and by functional assays, whereby we can take the human pancreas at 7 days to 10 weeks of development, and we can do collect every single cell in microwells to do SMARCSeq2, or here it was MARSeq. Or we can take the same cells that we grow in vitro as spheres. We can take the cells that we engineer from human ES cells or iPS cells from multiple lines. What do they become in 2D? How do they evolve in 3D? So the benchmark is the fetal human pancreas. Most of the cells are still progenitors, and here are the endocrine cells. And what we are plotting is here the distance of the cells mean how different they are from each other, taking all genes we investigated into consideration. The cells we produce in 2D, we and others, are not perfect. If you put an outgroup, they're very similar, but they're not perfect. However, when they are expanding in 3D, what you can see is that they converge to the state that they have in vitro, but not all the cells. So we don't know whether it's a difference, the spherical one and the more complex ones, or closer to an in vivo situation yet. The differences are, we can plot the difference between these two areas, and we can see that they acquire more pancreas progenitor markers, and that they, in 3D, what they do is that they have more proliferation capacity. The 2D system is confluent, stopping proliferation, so they can't behave as what we know of progenitors in vivo, which are very good at proliferating. And we can actually quantify the proliferation and benchmark it to the in vivo context. And we have similar rates of proliferation, a bit higher from ES cells or iPS cells. A big difference also what we see by moving from 2D to 3D is that in the beginning, the cells we produce in vitro have a co-expression of liver and pancreas genes. Very low levels, co-expressing single cells. And by going to 3D, they continue their program and they turn down the liver program. So these are progenitors, they proliferate. Another hallmark of progenitor is that it should be able to differentiate. We are not in a good situation to test whether they can differentiate to acinar cells because there's no good protocol. So we don't know whether they're multipotent or bipotent. But by default, there's very few little production of endocrine cells spontaneously. However, if we use media compositions that promote differentiation, we can see that it takes time, takes 17 days for the full differentiation to happen, but they eventually differentiate at least a subset of them into endocrine cells. So they have the ability to produce endocrine cells. So now that we have established the system, we're trying to use them to learn something. So the first thing we've started was to try to learn more about the differentiation into endocrine cells and learn more about the kinetics of the process. So we've built reporters that enable to track this transcription factor that is essential to produce pancreas progenitors in all species, to produce endocrine cells in all species. And we know that it's expressed in a peak of expression from mouse data, and that it's only expressed for a short time, about 24 hours, and it's turned off, and it then triggers all the targets, and endocrine cells differentiate. What we can do here is to follow the process and monitor every single cell to see how fast do they turn on, how long do they keep it, but now in human, and what is different from the mouse. So we have a fusion protein in red, which enables us to follow the protein. And then we monitor with the P2A, the transcriptional activity, the accumulation of the transcripts over time. So we can do, we can observe as the cells leave the epithelium and start aggregating at the surface, and how do they, how attracted they are to the epithelium. But most importantly, we can quantify over hundreds of cells how these genes is turned on, and with a similar system in mouse, we can compare it. So we can see, for instance, that in human, there's a peak of expression that's much longer than in the mouse. So the peak of expression lasts more than 24 hours, whereas in mouse, it lasts until only 12 hours. So the kinetics are about twice slower in human. This is something we also see with other reporters on cell proliferation. It's 2 to 2.5 times slower, proliferating 2 to 2.5 times slower in human than in our mouse system, even when we use the same media compositions. This is a recurring theme. You may have heard papers in the nervous system from James Briscoe's lab, differentiation into neurons is about twice slower, and from Miki Ebisuya in somite formation, also about twice slower. We don't know why yet. There's a lot of debate. I won't go into them now, but we can discuss them afterwards. So we can also exploit the fact that we can generate a lot of cells to try to do parallel investigations. So we can now do interferences in screening formats. So for the sake of time, I won't show you this. This is in the published sets of data where we worked only with 30 different molecules that we tested in 96 well-placed in quadruplicates, and we identified several pathways that either decrease proliferation, the accumulation of cells just by luminometry, or increase the accumulation of cells. And here we found differences with mouse. The pathways are the same, but the actual molecules doing the job seem to be different. For instance, FGF2, 9, and 13 seem to be the dominant ones in the pancreas, both in the in vitro system, but also expressed in the transcriptome in vivo, whereas FGF10 does the job in mouse. Also, we see the importance of the EGF pathway. In mouse, it's beta-cellulin EGF. In the human, we find unfear-regulating and GGF-alpha as dominant, at least from expression. But this was a simple screen. Now we've moved on in Dresden to very large screens, not 10,000, but about 600 different molecules in 384 well plates, whereby we can seed. So we have here in a plate about 8 million nuclei and about 100,000 objects in single wells. So you can see a single well here, you can see the different objects, and you can see a single object with its cells. So we capture the images with high resolution, just endpoint screening, and then we do image analysis to identify compounds, so chemical compounds, that can modify both the architecture that we follow with actin of the single objects, or the different cell types, progenitors with the live reporters, reporter for progenitors, or for endocrine progenitors, here in red. So we identify compounds, nothing on endocrine cells, but compounds that modify the expression levels of this gene in progenitors, higher, lower, but also changes in cell shape. So you have a compound here that transforms the object into all very small spheres. So with this ability, we started with drugs. But eventually, the potential is to be able to start exploit what we know from human genetics. Because of diabetes, a lot of human geneticists have identified a lot of genes that predispose people to developing diabetes later in life. And as a developmental biologist, I think that they are underestimating how much of these genes control the development and predispose people by controlling the development itself. And we know that from a few examples. So for instance, this gene, GLIS3, is the gene that predisposes people to developing type 1 and type 2 diabetes, but later in their life, when they have mild heterozygous mutations. But when people have homozygous mutations or compound heterozygous mutations, they already develop diabetes at birth. So something must have gotten wrong during development. And they develop diabetes. We don't know exactly why. We have a little information from mouse data, but we know that they also have malformations in the kidney, polycystic kidney disease, and so larger ducts in the kidney, also in the liver, they have a thyroid gland defect. So in the pancreas, we know that they become diabetic, and in very few patients, cysts have been observed. They're very, very few. So we've created a knockout for this gene, and what we observe is that actually, when we knock it out, we have a large dominance of the objects that become cystic and spherical. So we can quantify that. You can see it like with a single image here, but we can also quantify it. We see that in the mutant, the object becomes cystic. And we know that this comes from increased cell numbers and actually an increased proliferation at early time points. Now, we've done transcriptome analysis, and we understand the mechanisms better. What we don't understand yet is the links with diabetes, and do they differentiate less endocrine cells? So I've been a little shallow about many things, but I hope I could convince you that we can use organoid systems to do things we can't do in vivo. Control cell assemblies, external signals to understand emergent properties in very small objects, to study the mechanical control of development and get insight into human development, notably interferences, which are very easy, and you can study many organoids in parallel in screening formats. I don't want to be too rosy. There are issues with organoids. The benchmarking is hard. You always find differences, and you never know whether these differences will matter. And I don't think we're going to be able to resolve that. The relevance to in vivo observations are difficult to do. When we see these rotations, what do they actually mean in vivo? I think they mean something, but probably they mean that the cells can act as a collective. But how do they act as a collective in an in vivo setting? We don't know. I have a big concern, which is I think the medium can be masking some defects when you do you test genetic function. If you have inactivated a gene, but in your medium you have something that acts downstream, everything is going to be masked, and we're starting to see that. And the heterogeneity of objects can be a problem, but I could show you that at least in spite of the heterogeneity, we can find compounds that can modify phenotypes. With this, I would like to thank the people in the lab who've done the work. So it's been a lot of collaborators. I've named them on each single picture. And we also have great collaborations because we can't do everything. There are a lot of things that are too complicated for us. And collaborating, I think, is the way forward. Thank you for your attention.